You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jackie Battenfield. Jackie, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's nice to be speaking with you, Brainerd.
Jackie, let's talk about what you're doing in your studio. You seem to be a very prolific artist to me, and I'm curious what you're working on lately or what your current medium is or how you're approaching work.
Well, I'm working full-time in the studio, which is quite wonderful, except for taking time off to go to Pilates classes. But I'm working on Mylar, which is a polyester and a non-absorbent surface, and I'm working with very thin layers of acrylic paint, mixing pigments together, and because of the physics of the pigments and the relatively different atomic weights, some, like an earth pigment is a very heavy pigment, a man-made pigment such as a anthraquinone blue is a very light pigment. Somehow during the drying process, they start separating and they start creating these amazingly wonderful fractal and patterned areas in it. But I'm working on leaves and trees. I mean, I'm taking a very, very specific subject. I've always been interested in landscape, even when my work was abstract. There's always seemed to be some sort of reference to landscape in it. But I don't consider myself a landscape artist. But I'm working with a very specific image and then creating this whole other sort of abstraction within it and their long-term meditations, like painting a whole tree leaf by leaf, each leaf doing its own little thing. Quite wonderful. And took me a long time to find the kind of the process and the image that seems to work perfectly for me. So I'm very happy in the studio these days.
So that work on Mylar, is that what also is was recently shown at a Case Barnes Fine Art in Larchmont? You have
mm-hmm.
an exhibit there of
yeah.
work that sounds
right.
So
it was just
when you're painting on Mylar, I mean, I want to get more into that, but also how are these then stretched on panel or like canvases? Because they look like canvases.
Well, they're mounted on panel, yes. Mylar is like, you know, there's no reason to put a Mylar painting, at least what I do with Mylar, under glass. A lot of Mylar is treated that way, like a work on paper. No, but I have it mounted, the paint's on top, because I want the viewer to be more intimate with it. A piece of glass separates you from a piece of art, and so I figured out a way to get them mounted. And so they look like canvases. They have this kind of wonderful sort of porcelain-like surface in which is quite, you know, compelling, and they still retain a little luminosity, which Mylar as a material is, you know, translucent, and I retain that translucency the way I have them mounted. So they're kind of special, I think. And, you know,
but it is also the surface, right? You said, like, mistakenly said surface, but it is also that Mylar has a very different surface, right? Because are these primed, or are you painting on
nope,
raw Mylar?
They're not primed. Well, they are treated. Mylar I use is actually has a very prosaic name, drafting film, and it was originally it still is used with architects to print the schematics for a building plan on it, because unlike paper, it will not shrink or warp or change, and so you can get very accurate measurements from it. And that's where so it's a polyester that, you know, the surface is slightly abraded so that it will accept the paint and that will retain the paint. You can't, like, if you buy one of those funny Mylar balloons that are kind of silver and shiny, you know, paint won't stick to that very easily, because it's you know, it's not meant to do that.
So this Mylar is meant for artists to paint on. That's why it sounds.
Oh yeah,
a,
lots of people
I don't know
use
if truth
it.
Is the right word, but it has some kind of a.
Well, sometimes artists like to call it vellum, which is that's the highfalutin name for it. And I noticed there's the Jasper Johns. I found mylar by looking at works of Jasper Johns. He uses it a lot, but he uses ink on it, and he frames it under glass. And right now, the show that's up at Matthew Marks has a series of pieces of his that are on mylar, but they call it vellum. But it's not vellum, because that's kind of a very specific calf skin treatment.
And
people
Jasper
do
Johns
like to say
using,
that
he's
these
using
days.
Ink right on there. He's not using
and he
oil
uses
paint
ink
or acrylic.
No, he's using inks on his mylar.
Which doesn't even sink into the surface. It's not like a typical paper.
It can't, because it's not absorbent. It won't absorb. It's not absorbent like canvas. And a gessoed canvas, the gesso has absorbent qualities.
So that's a whole different way of painting, really. I mean,
most artists
are working with paper or canvas. I mean, I suppose, mm-hmm. Encaustic, of course, is something else altogether.
Mm-hmm.
But working on mylar, you're working on a non-absorbent surface. So even
mm-hmm.
how things are built up or the way you create a kind of translucent, because it almost looks like you can see through the leaves, like there's a kind of light. Is that because the white surface is kind of unusually bright and gives a kind of translucence?
Well, it does kind of, because the paint I use very thin veils of paint. I've always thinned down my paint. Even when I painted on canvas, it was stains, it was thin. I like thin paint.
And so congratulations on that, and it's exciting to hear, of course, that you're working full-time in the studio, which I want to talk about. Is there anything else you want to say about your work before I talk about your book? Because I don't know if you're having upcoming shows that you want to mention, or if I should have asked you another question about how you're working that you want to discuss.
No, I'm fine. We can go on to the book.
Okay, so as you said in the beginning of this, you're working full-time as an artist, and I know that you also had a background working for nonprofits years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you work in Brooklyn as, I think it was, gallery director for
I started a small nonprofit gallery, which now has grown to be something of a part of a really wonderful, exciting organization called BRIC, B-R-I-C. They now do incredible programming, performance, everything in the world. I'm very, very proud of, the little baby beginnings that I started nurturing in its first decade, and now today it's all grown up and is really one of the most significant exhibition spaces in Brooklyn that provides tremendous opportunity for, so many artists in all disciplines.
And is it still in the same space where you started?
No. We had to move a few times. We, started out with a free space in Brooklyn Borough Hall. Then we moved to another free space in one of the Parks Department's buildings. And then we finally made our own space. And now it has its own building near BAM in the Brooklyn Arts District.
Well, that's very exciting. I mean, it's also exciting because years ago I actually had one of my first shows in that space, which was a big thrill for me. So I know that space well, and it was wonderful. I was not only treated well there, but it was the idea also of a nonprofit not only embracing work that at the time was outside the marketplace, but also got press, and it kind of, in a way, launched my own kind of activities and career in New York, as nonprofits can do, right? This is really, as I always see it, the role of nonprofits to help emerging as well as established artists get their voice out there in a manner that doesn't have commercial pressure on them.
That's true, and I think that's why the nonprofits are such an important part of the, art ecology, the art world ecology. We need that. They're great, feeding grounds to all sorts of other opportunities. I think a lot of artists these days, are making art that's not meant for a commercial space or as a commercial product, and, they couldn't do it without the nonprofits. They wouldn't have any visibility.
Right. So let's talk about your book, because of course it came out of that experience, starting a nonprofit, and I imagine also gave you a background in what it takes for something like that to be established. But of course that's quite a bit different than an artist establishing their own practice and having some commercial viability, meaning that you can sell work, have regular shows, and have that be your main income source, which is, as I understand, where you're at now. And isn't that also what your book is primarily about, how artists establish? It's called The Artist's Guide, How to Make a Living Doing What You Love.
Well, I think it's a bit about that, and I don't think a commercial, having working with commercial space, is the only way for an artist to have a career and have a life doing what you love. You know, I believe, for me, I make objects, I make paintings, you know, I make prints, that's my practice. I don't look a lot to the nonprofit world to show my work, but, you know, I did make a concerted effort to promote myself in, you know, to a marketplace that had a collector base that would be interested in the work that I do. So, yes, that's one way to go about it. But doing what I do, I don't apply for there's wonderful project grants, and there's all sorts of funding out there for an artist that wants to make work that's more project oriented, that's less dependent on the marketplace. There's other revenue streams have come along to help artists do that. Certainly, the plethora of project grants for artists, those are just incredible, and they're growing. The opportunities to do your own fundraising, the support of a nonprofit space, those are all sorts of ways. And frankly, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book, I talk about money, that for most artists, even those like me who mainly make a product that might find a buyer, it's always good to have multiple income streams, to have other ways that you can, you know, have money coming in, so that if one part of your practice isn't doing so well, you have something else to fall upon. And I think that's really crucial, and I think that's the way, you know, self-employed people have to pretty much live their life. You know, I teach this class at Columbia University, and I walk my students through the idea, you know, all my Columbia students, even though they've gotten into a very competitive MFA program, and they are making amazing work, you know, most of them will find it hard to make a living only from their creative product. So what else can they do? What other things other ways that they can make an income that's not completely soul-sucking. We have artists, we're creative, we have multiple ways to think creatively about our life and about how we're going to fund it.
So let's talk about some of those ways, and perhaps the ways that you use most to your advantage. And is that something like working with consultants, for example, or interior decorators? Is that kind of one of the income streams you're talking about, or one of the income streams that you've used?
Well, I certainly use that income stream, but that's not applicable to all people. I would think, you know, for some artists, even having a day job is a welcome relief from the studio. You know, my practice involves long hours all by myself, you know, a community of one, that doesn't work for all types of artistic personalities. So collaborators, collaborating with theater, with other disciplines, also, you know, for years, the thing was, you know, get your MFA and find yourself a teaching job. It was a great way to fund your art practice. And many artists do it that way. That's become less of a viable income stream these days, because there's just, you know, there's not as many jobs,
well,
and there's too much
right.
competition. But, you know, if your work is video installation, also, you know, doing video editing for other people, doing some commercial work as well. It doesn't necessarily, it's not necessarily work that you hate, or developing a business that services the art industry in some way. So, you know, installing art in the museums or in galleries, or as a photographer, having your own, you know, portfolio of photographic work, but also, you know, photographing other people's work, or being, you know, documenting what's in the for the galleries. So there's lots of ways to do this that's creative, and that doesn't necessarily, you know, that allows you to balance the work that you want to do, the, you know, that your soul, what you so much want to put out into the world in your own way, with another income stream.
So let's talk about what else your book proposes in terms of income streams. What are the, some of the things that your book that you think is most important to mention in terms of ways artists can be thinking about that?
Well, I mean, looking seriously for funding. You know, one of the things I walk my my students through, and when I do workshops, is say, if you have a project with a I'm going to backtrack one step. This is what's interesting. Most artists don't really consider what it costs for them to make their art. What's it going to cost? What's the price? They don't want to know how much it costs for them to make their art, because it's a scary number. But when you say an artist is offered a project opportunity, they're offered a project room, or they're doing something for a nonprofit somewhere, and this nonprofit says to them, oh, wonderful, please, we want you to, you're going to be the project artist coming up in 6 months' time, here's the space, and we have this lovely artist fee for you of $1,000. And my thinking is, I counsel artists, I said, sit down and look at what you plan to do in that space, and put together a budget, a real budget. What's it really going to cost you to make that nonprofit look good? And you share that budget with the nonprofit, and you say, look, thank you, I'm glad we have this $1,000 artist fee, but let me show you what the budget is for this project, and say that budget is $4,300. How can we make this work? Bring the nonprofit into being a partner on this. The fact is that artists don't know how much it really costs them to make their work. They're extremely ambitious when given an opportunity. They spend like a drunken sailor, and then they end up being in debt by the time their project premieres. And what do they walk away with? They walk away with credit card bills. So the idea of looking carefully, looking expansively for how you can fund a project, what could be in-kind funding, what can the organization supply for you that they hadn't thought of lately, how can you use their nonprofit status to maybe apply for other pieces of money out there, the Will of Kickstarter or some other online fundraising program work in a way. You know, when I went to write my book, I put together a budget. What was it going to cost me to write this book? And the first thing I did is I got fiscal sponsorship. I then went looking and did fundraising to help me write the book before I actually wrote the book, because otherwise it was going to be taking away from my own studio practice. I wasn't going to be having any exhibitions during the period of time this book was being written, but I still have to support myself because I'm self-employed. So sometimes it slows down a project. You know, one of my colleagues at Creative Capital, Aaron Landsman, says a really great phrase. He says, you know, try to do less with more. The idea is that figure out what you need and really get the funding in place, even if it might mean negotiating with somebody to like put off that doing that project for 6 months or so that when you go to premiere it and you go to do it, you actually have the funding in place. We're all in a hurry. We want to do it. This is our opportunity. We want visibility, but we don't take the time to do the things that we need to do. When I was running a nonprofit gallery, every year I had to raise the funding to make that space, those exhibitions, work. How was I going to do that? It was always a basket full of a variety of funding to make that happen. And I think I learned that and applied that to my own practice. So, you know, I teach. I do some workshops. I have that one class at Columbia that I teach. I make, you know, yes, I do. These days I make 95% of my income from actual sales of my art and from, you know, licensing. But the rest, hasn't always been true.
And in your book, you discuss how that income stream that you just mentioned comes about, which is licensing and sales?
Sure. I talk about all the different ways that you might look for opportunities to fundraise, either for a project or for your own life.
That seems so important and so essential for artists, right?
Well, and I make my Columbia students go through a month of financial tracking. I said, many of you are living on loans. It's funny money. You're not really considering what it costs for you to live in New York City, which many of you want to be here next year after you graduate. What's that going to cost you? And I want you to start thinking now, how am I going to fund that? Because you're not going to graduate from an MFA program, most of you are not going to graduate into suddenly having this, you know, dynamic marketplace and have all the funding in the world. You're going to be, like, struggling for a while. And the fact is, artists are consistently underfunded. And because we don't know how much it costs for us to make our art, we don't discuss it. And because we don't discuss it, the world thinks they can get our art for nothing.
And so, I agree, and that's such an important distinction and point to make. And so, in terms of getting that funding, though, I know there are a number of methods discussed in your book. One is obviously working with nonprofits and hoping that they can work with you on it. And when you work with your students in your class, are there other methods that you discuss as well, which are, of course, in your book?
Well, fiscal sponsorship is really great because you don't have to work with a nonprofit, but you can apply to a nonprofit that's set up to offer fiscal sponsorship, such as the New York Foundation for the Arts or for Fractured Atlas, and you can take your project and put together a budget, put together a description of your project, and apply for them to host through fiscal sponsorship, and that way you can apply to a lot of avenues for funding that can't give money to an individual artist but can provide the money, can send the money to the nonprofit for the project of a individual artist. So the money I raised for my book, none of those foundations could have provided that money to me directly as an individual artist. They weren't set up to do so, but they could send that money to the project at the New York Foundation for the Arts in support of it. And that's the difference. And I think artists need to take more advantage, especially project-based artists, need to take more advantage of using those type of opportunities to do it. It's like, don't wait for Creative Capital to give you the grant. Put together the project and start working on your own through a fiscal sponsor.
And obviously, once you get fiscal sponsorship, of course, you need to find the grant to raise the...
It's a lot of work, absolutely. I mean, it's not simple, it's not easy, and it does require, you know, doing some research, reaching out, putting together grant proposals. And I suppose that's one of the things that I learned starting a nonprofit and doing that fundraising, you know, I learned early on, and so I wasn't scared to do it myself.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Is there anything else you want to mention about the book before I ask you the last question? There'll be links, of course, for people to look at it more and buy it. But is there anything else you want to mention about
it? You know, it's
book?
Just a practical guide. It's mentoring. It's simple things that we can do, but we don't do it. I just wanted, it's just words from one artist who's self-employed and makes a living doing what they love. And I'm not trying to sell anybody on career services or on coaching or anything like that. It's just, I just felt like, you know, I had to get it out there.
Well, I'm so glad you did. And I want to ask you the last question, which is, what are you reading at that moment? I'm curious.
Well, actually, I'm an avid reader. I love mystery. I love mystery novels. They're kind of addictive. You know, it's something you can pick up and you just kind of speed right through it, and it doesn't. So right now I'm working my way through all of P.D. James, and she's a British writer, and she's quite amazing. They're wonderful novels. And but on the art side, I just finished reading Ninth Street Women, which is absolutely incredible. It's a huge book, 500 or 600 pages, and 200 pages are just footnotes. It's just incredible about the careers and the lives of Lee Krasner, Elaine de Kooning, Helen Frankenthaler, Grace Hartigan, and Joan Mitchell, and it takes place in the years 1929 through 1959, and so through some of the WPA, and it's a view of the art world from the point of view of those women, which is so amazing, and it's just filled with all sorts of people you know and places you've thought about, and it's a great point of view, and I highly, highly recommend it.
Jackie, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.